Hello and welcome to episode number 199 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S-E-A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S-E-A.
What do we have to drink this week?
We have the Reuben from our friends at Reuben's Brews. The Reuben's Brews Bits and Bops. It's easy for you to say.
It actually would have been easy for me to say. From our good friends at Reuben Brews, here's what they say. Every year we create a new IPA using unique hops, malts, or processes we recently discovered. This is our chance to innovate with the bits and bobs that we are so excited about as an expression of the new and innovative IPA profiles we love. IPAs are evolving, and they are in this bottle right here. Let's crack this open, because we've got at least one toast to get to this week.
We do, yes. All right, a toast to Steve Rabel.
To Rabes!
Who announced last week his retirement as an anchor on Cairo 7, a role he's held basically our entire lives that we can remember,
yes.
Certainly.
As we if we're remembering some years, Steve Rabel was in those years as anchor on Cairo TV.
His tenure will end in the late spring. He will continue in his role as radio voice of the Seahawks.
There we go.
So, there you go, Rabes.
That sounds kind of nice. Right? It always seemed kind of crazy that he was doing the news basically five nights a week and then traveling for the Seahawks in the fall. That is a busy sketch.
Yes, I'm sure he's looking forward to retirement.
Well, of course, Steve Rabel, previously retired from the Seahawks, wide receiver opposite Steve Largent, and then transitioning to evening TV news anchor. Is like a pretty wild transition.
It's also like one of those things where if you didn't know that Steve Rabel, if he wasn't doing the Seahawks games and you didn't know that Steve Rabel played for the Seahawks, I don't know that you would ever guess that he played for a Seahawks. He just seems like a news guy.
Would never put it together.
Yeah.
Yeah. If like growing up, we probably like borderline knew that info.
I mean, he was always involved with Seahawks broadcast, so I figure we always did on some level.
But yeah, it's like Dennis Bounds didn't play for the Seahawks as far as I know.
That's true. He did not.
And I feel like maybe something that probably wouldn't happen nowadays.
Well, probably the fact that guys make a lot more money in the NFL, and then it's also you're probably playing catch up in a different way than you were in the 70s. So yeah, I think it probably will become increasingly less common to see that crossover.
Well, anyway, the ball is in your court, Mac Strong.
I thought you were going to transition there too. Rabel was broadcasting the Seahawks. He was a color analyst in 1999 when they made the playoffs.
Hello.
For the first time in our entire period following the Seahawks, our entire period that we could remember. So should we get into Let's Remember Some Years?
Let's remember 1999. A unique year. This was supposed to be...
I mean, every year is a unique year when you think about it.
1999 is an interesting one, though. The more that I dived into looking at 1999, I was like, oh, this is a year. I feel like we've been waiting for this one.
Should we talk about Y2K here, off the top?
We're starting with Y2K?
We gotta start with Y2K. It was the dominant theme of 1999.
We definitely had, like, a certain level of panic about it. There was that Family Guy episode where Y2K happens, and then they start a whole new community. Like, I distinctly remember watching that and being, like, a little concerned.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely, like, it seemed like a legitimate fear that we didn't know what was going to happen. And then it turned out it just was the plot of the movie Office Space.
That's what I was going to say, is like, we'll talk about film later, but like Y2K was basically a plot in the movie Office Space.
Yes. I don't remember being specifically frightened on New Year's Eve 1999, though. I just mostly remember having the glasses that had the zero zeros as the lenses. Not as the lenses. Yeah.
Okay, so New Year's Eve 1999. I feel like we were together. I was sitting at Grandma and Grandpa's house.
Yeah, I think so.
Like, I think it was just you and me. Nobody else was there.
Wait, what? Everyone else went out and left us there?
I'm pretty sure it was just you and me there.
That seems kind of unlikely.
Because I remember sitting in Grandma and Grandpa's back living room, watching news radio as midnight hit. And I was like, it was in the episode that Tiffany Amber Thiessen was on. I distinctly remember sitting there.
I don't remember Tiffany Amber Thiessen being on News Radio.
Short guest on News Radio.
Huh.
And her being on that episode, and then it clicked over to midnight, and I was like, huh, I guess it's the year 2000 now. I was like, nothing happened.
It really didn't change that much. And it was just having to go from writing 99 to 00, which was a big adjustment, I would say.
Yeah.
Bigger even than like a 19 to 20 in a new decade.
It was a thing that we thought about, though, like throughout the year.
For sure. I mean, you know, there definitely was uncertainty about it. And just the excitement of party like it's 1999, the new decade.
The millennium, if you will.
Yes. In my case,
Robbie Williams,
being
millennium.
Part of the graduating class of 2000.
I know. We'll talk about that next year. I always felt like that was like a pretty fun graduating class.
Possibly literally the definition of a millennial, depending on how you cut it off. But we're not, you know, as you say, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about 99.
Okay, so the Seahawks make the playoffs under Mike Holmgren.
First year. John Kitna is quarterback.
This is for the first time since 1980.
I want to say 87, but that might be going too far back. Maybe it was 88. It was somewhere in that range, though.
It is kind of funny when you look at these teams where, like, the Patriots were a laughingstock, right, for a couple of decades.
Correct.
And that the Patriots are now known as, like, basically the class of NFL franchises for the last two decades. The Seahawks right in there. I mean, we've looked at this last decade. But the Seahawks really, they're still kind of on the run that they started in 1999.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to their Pro Football Reference page, there's this huge gap between it was 88 that they lost in the division round and 99. And then, you know, really 2003, I guess you would say, was the start of it. Since then, they have not missed the playoffs in more than two consecutive seasons and have missed the playoffs a total of four times in the past 17 seasons.
Yeah.
So it's a very different environment. I mean, the funny thing is the 90s Seahawks weren't necessarily terrible. Like, they had, under Dennis Erickson, their records were 8-8, 7-9, 8-8, 8-8. They were just the most average team
but
possible.
But that was, we considered those teams to be like bounce back teams from how bad they were in the early 90s.
Correct. I mean, there was the stretch of 2-14, 6-10, 6-10 under Tom Flores.
Dennis Erickson, let me give you a Husky comparison. Dennis Erickson.
He was the Sark?
Is the Sark of the Seahawks. You needed a transition coach.
Wow.
Just to get you back to competence.
So
because
that made Pete Carroll the Jimmy Lake? Because if so, I mean, we're in good shape.
Wait.
He's also got like 40 years until he gets to Pete Carroll's age.
I guess that is true. No, I haven't. I think we might know who Jimmy Lake is. Defensive backs coach. Came in really hot, changing the program. Young guy.
I don't know about came in really hot, changing the program.
I'm just saying there was a coach in between those two coaches. It didn't go Mike Holmgren to Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
You know what I'm implying here.
I did not really think about that. Oh, no.
We don't know who the Pete Carroll is of Husky football. Maybe it's Pete Carroll.
Oh, wow. I didn't even consider that. So that 99 season, the Seahawks, it seemed like we're not just going to make the playoffs. We're actually going to be very competitive. They started out the season 8-2. This was also near the end of their era in the AFC West. Got a big win at Kansas City to go to 8-2. And then proceeded to lose their next four games in a row.
1999 us must have been semi-excited. Was this Charlie Rogers was on the team, right?
Yes, Charlie Rogers was my favorite Seahawk.
And
at this
we
time.
Loved Charlie Rogers.
Yep.
Galloway was still on the team?
That was the year that Joe Galloway held out, played the eight games that was required to fulfill his contract.
So actually after the team got bad is when Joey Galloway came back.
That is correct.
What about Corn Robinson? Is this too early for Corn Robinson?
This is too early for Corn Robinson.
Okay.
The other receivers on that team, Sean Dawkins was the leader in targets and yardage. Derek Mays was the leader in receptions. And then Mike Pritchard was still around.
Mike Pritchard. Wow.
Yeah.
First round draft pick was defensive end out of Saginaw Valley State.
Yes.
Whose name was Lamar.
Lamar Hunt? King. Lamar King. No, yes, Lamar Hunt. They named, he was so good, they named the trophy after him. Lamar Hunt, who in his career had...
Lamar King.
Lamar King, yes, 12 sacks.
We'll see if Collier gets there.
That's the over-under. I don't know. I think the other under on LJ Collier, as it turns out. He did have a 6-sack season in his second year. Did not make a lot of impact as a rookie. Yeah, so one of the games I remember a lot that season is there was a showdown at home against Tampa Bay, who had just replaced Trent Dilfer with Sean King. And Tampa Bay at that point They were only 6-4 coming into that game, but they ended up 11-5. They won five of their last. They won eight of their last nine games. They were the anti-Seahawks and finished 11-5. But the Seahawks did get the one win they needed at home against Kansas City on the day after Christmas, 1999. And then I have
no recollection of this game at all.
Me neither. Kansas City lost the next week. There was a field goal at the end of the game that either was missed or made that allowed the Seahawks to back into the playoffs as the AFC West champions at 9-7.
Hello.
While losing at the Jets, 19-9. And
kind of like Pete Carroll's first season.
Yes.
Actually, kind of
certainly better than that. But then in the playoffs, technically in the year 2000, lose to the Miami Dolphins during Dan Marino's final win as an NFL player before they got clobbered by the Jaguars the next week. A game where Charlie Rogers returned to kickoff for a touchdown, one of the few highlights for the Seahawks in that 2017 loss.
Well, if Chris were here, he would say that he was at the Kingdom at the time. This might have been
the last game at the Kingdom.
Last game
we are nearing
at the Kingdom.
We are nearing the 20th anniversary of the Kingdom being demolished.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next year.
Well, but there's an entire podcast lined up for the anniversary of that, which is later this month.
Wait, do we really?
Just you wait. There's a celebrity interview.
That I'm unaware of?
I guess you're unaware of it. Have I not told you about it? There was somebody who has expressed a Kingdom take that we have discussed on this very podcast that I interviewed about it.
I have no idea.
Who worked at the Kingdom.
Who worked at the Kingdom.
Yeah, that's all the teasers you get. Maybe some people will remember who that person was.
So the last game at the Kingdom, Chris would say, because he was there sitting in the first row of the 200 level, pretty good seats, and he would say that the Seahawks kept getting sacked because of a resistance to run the shotgun formation.
Oh, yeah, Holmgren very much hated to run the shotgun at that point, I feel like.
Did he ever start liking the shotgun? Because to me,
they were very low in their usage of it throughout his tenure.
When I picture Matt Hass, he's under center.
Yes.
What about the Sonics? So this was the strike-shortened season.
Also, one of the memories, so this was the first year we ever went to a Seahawks regular season game.
Yeah, the Cincinnati Bengals with their 3-4 defense.
Exotic back then.
Oh,
the Seahawks
man.
Won it 37-20. One of the things I remember from that is using Amon Green as a short yardage back, where he averaged 4.6 yards per carry, although we know that yards per carry is not that good a metric. But I remember that not being a great use of Amon Green, and then he went to Green Bay. It was just like a
excellent.
Very good.
God, their middle linebackers. It was Brian Simmons and
Takeo Spikes.
Takeo Spikes. Yeah. God, frightening middle linebackers from the Cincinnati Bengals.
Yeah. So those are some 99 Seahawks memories. That's the Sonics. So the lockout ended in early January.
Okay.
They're coming back. It's a 50-game season. They have a new coach. They've hired Paul Westfall, Sonics legend Paul Westfall.
Wow.
Who had his one thrilling season in Seattle where they didn't make the playoffs in between going to the going to the Western Conference Finals and then like being a 50-win team against the next year. He was there the year in between because he got injured partially. And Gus Williams didn't.
Really? That was when Paul Westfall was
here? Who we should mention, by the way, Gus Williams, very sad news, suffered a stroke last week. At his winter home in South Carolina. So hoping the best for his recovery, certainly, as he battles that. Anyways, Paul Westfall named the coach. The Sonics remake their roster a little bit. Gone is Jim McElvain. He got traded weirdly for Michael Cage, who did not make the roster.
I didn't even know that he got traded for Cage.
Gone is Detlef Schrempf, who signed with Portland as a free agent.
The long history of Sonics ending their careers in Portland.
I don't know it's that long. Who else?
Well, Kemp played there.
Not at the end of his career, but yes.
But late-stage Sonics in Portland.
Yes. The Sonics signed two prominent members of the Sacramento Kings.
Hello.
Billy Owens and Olin Polonais.
B.O. Oh, my God. B.O. and O.P. They really were, like, those were their nicknames.
Also, classic draft that year. This was 98, but they had Rashard Lewis got drafted.
Oh, man. And Elo was the previous year?
No, Elo was, like, 2 years before. We never really discussed him. But he was 96, 97.
It is kind of crazy how Craig Elo is like sort of an NBA legend in a way.
He's a prominent NBA figure.
We hated Craig Elo.
He was very bad by the time they got him. I don't think that was Craig Elo's fault. He just was washed.
Okay,
was
so
bad signing.
Billy Owens, who kind of seemed like a modern NBA player, right? He was a bigger small forward who could kind of do everything. Maybe he wasn't a great shooter.
He was not.
But we had high hopes for Billy Owens.
I mean, we were excited about this. I remember in the preseason, or maybe this was early in the season, Billy or Olden Polonies talking about how now the Sonics aren't playing 4-on-5 on offense anymore.
Wow.
Perkins was also gone at this point, I believe, too.
Oh, dang. Well, he went to Indiana?
Yes. It was like really kind of a start of a new era for the Sonics. But again, there was hopes.
Big Smooth could still be in the NBA.
I don't think he could. Shouts to Big Smooth. And the Sonics come out at the start of this lockout shortened season. And they win their first...
I thought it was 8 in a row.
That sounds right. It was actually only 6 in a row, including the captain. And this was a great season. Loved the NBA. They beat the Utah Jazz. The final score was 71-56.
56?
71-56. This is Utah Jazz who had been to the NBA Finals each of the two previous seasons.
Wow. I think the Blazers scored that in the first half tonight.
Most teams score that in the first half.
Wow.
I mean, 56 is like an average NBA half now. They scored more than 18 points in any quarter in that game.
So their first loss, if I recall correctly, came on the road to...
And Utah came into the game 6-0, by the way. So it was a showdown.
A thrilling rookie by the name of White Chocolate.
That is correct. Jason Williams was taking the NBA by storm. The Kings, having regrouped from the loss of Olden Polonies and Billy Owens, had added Jason Williams, Chris Webber, and Vlade Divac. Hired Rick Allen as coach.
Wow.
And suddenly became like the most fun team to watch in the NBA.
That month
of Jason Williams was so exciting.
I think he shook Gary Payton.
Correct.
In that game.
One of his main highlights, yes.
And it was just like, wow.
He was like, this is a new generation.
This is basketball. Basketball to come. We have witnessed it.
So there's another thing that happened early this season we haven't talked about, which is that...
Mucci Norris.
Odellif was still on the team here this year. I got my timing wrong. So what happened is that Paul Westphal, in his wisdom, decided to start Millie Owens at shooting guard and decided not to start Hersey Hawkins, holdover from the 98 team. Was a much better outside shooter, much better compliment.
And
to
also,
what
wasn't Billy Owens like 6'8 and couldn't shoot?
Yeah.
Oh,
and was
my God.
Badly out of shape, like many players were after the lockout, as it turns out.
Can you imagine in modern times starting Billy Owens at the two guard?
The Sixers can. So then,
is that a Tobias Harris joke? Who is that?
I mean, Tobias, they actually like. They just have a weird lineup, but they don't have enough shooting.
Sixers can.
Then Billy Owens gets hurt, and Paul Westphal decides, no, I'm not going to start with Hersey Hawkins, who had a long streak of consecutive starts. We asked him about this when we had him on the Pelton cast many years ago. I'll have to link that. Instead, he starts Rashard Lewis, a 19-year-old rookie second-round pick out of high school.
We loved Rashard, though. We knew Rashard was going to be good.
We were excited about Rashard. We didn't know he was going to be good until the next season. We'll talk about that.
I remember him being scrawny.
Oh, so skinny. So after the 6-0 start, the Sonics proceed to lose, I guess, only 9 of their next 12 games to drop it to 9-9.
They were 25-25 for the year, right?
And then, yeah, they basically just alternated wins and losses the rest of the way. Finished 25-25, do not make the playoffs. This was...
Oh, I thought they were the 8 seed that year.
No. No, the next year they made the playoffs, but this was like stunning that they did not make the playoffs. And the other thing that's going on here, Vin Baker, who misses a lot of free throws in a row to start the season. Those people who are badly out of shape after the lockout, a group that also includes Sean Kemp, definitely includes
Vin Baker.
I mean,
this was kind of the end of each of their careers.
Certainly their all-star careers, or, you know, the part of their career we think of. Vin, that season, to begin this year, during that 6-0 stretch, went 0 of 14 from the free throw line. Finally made one in his 7th game and improved to 1 of 20 on the season from the free throw line.
Wait, he only took 20 free throws all year?
No, that was it through his first 7 games. And that really kind of devastated his confidence. And in addition to the alcoholism that we didn't know about at the time, but later learned about, he went from, in 98, a guy who was a good replacement for Kemp, had made the Sonics an equally good, if slightly different team.
We really liked Vin Baker for that one year.
Really, really disastrously bad.
I mean, the lockout not only affected kind of a generation of players, I think. Basketball wasn't the same until LeBron in 2003. And even then, maybe even for a few years after that.
That's probably true. Until the rules changes in the 2004-05 Suns. That's the start of the modern era.
It took a solid 3 or 4 years to recover from this lockout.
I mean, trends were going this direction in terms of scoring being down. Well, but the loss of Jordan
was gone. Yeah. Whereas, like, there was who do you think was the biggest star? I mean, this was Tim Duncan's rookie year, right?
It was his second season. Malone was MVP for the second time in 3 years.
Like, you have players who just like knew.
The Spurs did win the championship that year.
I'm sure there are people who care about Karl Malone, but like I've heard Simmons talk about this sometimes, where it's like
the city of Salt Lake City exists.
But like Malone he's kind of been lost to history. He's not on TV. Like,
yeah,
the lasting effects of Karl Malone have been very minimal.
I don't remember watching a single game of that year's NBA Finals, which was Knicks Spurs.
Yeah, Nick. Good God, Knicks Spurs, and this was the year that the Knicks were the 8 seed. And went to the finals as the 8 seed. So that took a bit of the pressure off our backs.
Yeah, the Denver 94.
That was nice.
Then the Sonics had a lottery pick that year, Corey Maggette, who they traded to Orlando for Horace Grant.
We liked Corey Maggette. We liked that pick.
I mean, we never got a chance to. I never knew him as a Sonic because I recall that day I had a baseball game. I was playing baseball that summer with our cousin David. And so I missed the entire draft.
But, like, we wanted the Sonic. We knew who Corey Maggette was. Oh, sure. Thought he was going to be a good player.
Sure. And now a good color analyst.
Is he really?
Yeah. Oh, so, okay. Does nice work on the Clippers broadcast. So one of my defining memories that spring / summer is playing baseball for the only time I ever played organized baseball.
Have we talked about, we've discussed all of your hitting mailboxes.
We came up earlier. Okay. This was that. It was on the way to a baseball game.
You hit another Cunnington. 23 mailboxes.
It was a cul-de-sac, and they had like the group mailbox, much as you do in here.
Mailbox got hit here too. Wait, where were you?
I have not hit any mailboxes in over 20 years, good sir. I promise. I guarantee it. I think I got 2 hits all season.
Oh,
I was hit.
You got hit 2 times all season.
I was hit by pitch another couple of times. definitely my on base percentage was way higher than my slugging. I was ahead of my time in that regard. Played a lot of positions defensively. I was very versatile. Do you have any thoughts on this?
On you playing base? I never went to a single one of your games.
You didn't?
No.
I
only saw you play softball. Yeah, I had better stuff to do. You know, it was the millennium.
It wasn't yet.
I had injured high school at this point. I really had nothing better to do, actually.
I have almost no memories of this Mariners season. They went 79-83. This was the season they started in the Kingdom and then moved mid-season to Safeco Field.
I think this was the last year that I cared about the Mariners.
That sounds right. And we've discussed on other podcasts, the Lookout Landing pod, that them opening Safeco Field was the worst thing they ever could have done in terms of your interest in the Mariners.
I truly don't know why. I think I was headed in this direction anyway. And for whatever reason, they're just becoming exhausted with baseball, right? Like, this is not just me. This was a at least partially citywide thing. There are other people who felt this way.
I don't think there were that many people that felt that way. They were about to get their most popular ever.
I think there were people who were part of the like Griffey generation of Mariners fans who, I mean, when did they trade Griffey? He was on this team.
He demanded a trade after the season.
But so it was right after they went to Safeco, though.
Correct.
It was basically
the house that Griffey built, ironically.
Safeco wasn't Griffey's place. The Kingdom was for us as 90s Mariners fans.
This is like retroactively thinking this.
But I'm telling you, I just stopped caring instantly, basically. Right?
I don't think that's true of other people, though.
But the difference between me caring and not caring, I started hating the Mariners by 2001. Like, this was a transition year, at the very least.
So Jamie Moyer started the first ever game at the Kingdom, which got blown by the bullpen. Jose Mesa got the blown save.
Oh, God. Joe Table.
Well... Really, really a fitting summation of the Mariners in that era.
I do think that this was the time period that the Mariners transitioned from they were the team that we cared about and loved as children to they became the next generation of people's team.
You know who I was really excited about in 1999 was Gilmesh.
Oh, we loved Gilmesh.
Started 15 games, went 8-4 with a 4.73 ERA, and then
cloud-like numbers.
Suffered a serious injury in the 2000 season.
We legit thought Gilmesh was going to be good.
I guess he actually had some good years for the Royals back in the late 2000s, in the late aughts.
This was the last time that I cared about the Mariners at all. I remember actually that summer, the summer of 99, I guess, looking at the schedule and being like, okay, if the Mariners win, like going through it, you know, it was like July, and being like, if they win this game, this game, this game, they'll be back in playoff contention. And then I think 3 months later, I didn't care at all.
That sounds about right.
We'll maybe talk about this in the year 2000. Was that when I had my first girlfriend?
I mean, you would know better than I would, I hope.
I feel like it was the summer after. Well, so wait, my freshman year of high school would have been 99 and 2000, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And then my sophomore year would have been 2000 and 2001.
Yes.
I'm going to say it's in the year I was a sophomore. It was the summer after I was a sophomore. Maybe it was the summer after I was a freshman. It wasn't 99. Making sure that it wasn't 99 when I dated Roxy Girl 44.
You know what we never discussed last year, by the way? Well, this was a big miss. What? We didn't discuss Washington basketball.
Oh, wow. Because
they made the NCAA tournament for the first time again in our like lifetime as fans. That was the year I had followed like the Mark Sanford teams, but that team with Todd McCullough and Donald Watts was the first, and Deion Shootin' Luton was the first Husky team that, you know,
We cared a lot.
And so the next year, they make it back to the NCAA tournament. This was actually like the stronger team, really, of the two. In 99, started the season as the 14th-ranked team in the AP preseason poll.
But they played UConn early on, Jake Foscoll.
Yes, I believe they called it the Elite Eight tournament.
Because they lost to UConn the previous year.
Yes, in the Elite Eight. A rematch
matchup. Kill me right now. I actually don't think I'll beat. There maybe are two moments that I've been as devastated in sports. Super Bowl 49 before they canceled it. And then Rip Hamilton hitting that shot.
You think more so than 2006? Because like 2006, we actually had a shot.
It was just there was the one shot. It was like a different situation. Yeah. 2006, it fell apart.
Like immediately from win to loss.
Yes.
Oh, that was a tough one.
I think, I don't know. I don't know if I'm over it still.
You're still not over it.
I can't believe that we didn't talk about that. Because it actually was, one of those moments.
It was also another memory, because I remember watching that in our parents' bedroom.
I was in the basement.
TV.
We weren't together. It was one of mini sports memories where we were in the same house, but not together, which is unheard of now, right? It would be like insane if we were watching a sporting event in different places.
It's like you went upstairs to watch it in your bedroom, and I'm still in your living room.
I remember I had to shower because I was going to a show last football season, but when the Seahawks lost to the Niners, you know what I'm talking about? The 2 years ago against, oh God, who was that quarterback? The Garoppolo replacement, the second one after C.J. Beathard.
Nick Mullins.
Yeah, when the Seahawks lost to Nick Mullins. I was upstairs watching that game because I had to shower because I was going to a show.
Okay.
This was just like, we just weren't in the same room and didn't care to be. But it was like, Rip Hamilton hit that shot and I just collapsed to the ground.
Oh, no.
Right? It's just like, you can't feel a more sinking feeling than that. And that's what the NCAA tournament is all about.
So the 99 team, McCullough and Watts are seniors. Your point guards, you mentioned Senkyu Carey, who was the exciting freshman on that team. You know who he took playing time from?
Who was that?
A sophomore point guard by the name of Dan Dickow.
Oh, yes, of course.
Both ended up transferring, and the program fell apart. But in this moment, what happened is the Huskies...
We went to a game that year that was at Key Arena against New Mexico, right? And New Mexico had like a big man. Kenny Thomas. Yeah, I was going to say he was a solid NBA player.
They came in number 11 in the country. I believe they were undefeated at the time. The Huskies beat them 70-61. That was the first Husky basketball game we had ever attended. Because
really?
We never went to the old Heck Ed before
that
it was renovated.
That was the first ever game?
Yep. Yes, they came into that one 8-0, and the Huskies handed them a loss. So that was an exciting moment. But it was kind of an up-and-down non-conference. The Huskies lost to Gonzaga, something that back then was not yet a tradition.
Jesus.
I believe that it was the 99 Gonzaga team that made the run, right?
Dickow was a traitor.
Yeah, it was the 99 Gonzaga team that at Key Arena started their run to the Elite Eight. And
tournament was in Key Arena?
That was part of it. Also, they played Minnesota in the first round, and Minnesota had a bunch of players suspended for academic fraud. And if that doesn't happen, maybe the Huskies still dominate Washington basketball all these years later.
You can trace it all back to Minnesota in 1999.
And then they hired Dan Monson and promoted Mark Few.
Wow, that's actually kind of wild.
It is a shocking thing. So the Huskies were a 7 seed in the Midwest, much higher than the previous
year. Oh, God. Was this Zerbiak?
This is the Wally Zerbiak, yeah.
Fucking Wally Zerbiak.
Like, when Wally Zerbiak played for the Sonics, he was a very nice guy. Good interview.
I kind of forgot that he played for the Sonics.
Yeah. I mean, that was a very forgettable Sonics team. But I could never look at him and not think of that 99 game and Bob Bender's just complete refusal to change up his defense, even the slightest bit, to account for the fact that Wally Zerbiak is going off and he's on Miami of Ohio. It's not like they had another guy. It was just Wally Zerbiak.
I distinctly remember because you couldn't, like, we were kids. We didn't have means to watch these games.
Yeah, it was
unless
the middle
your
of the
science
day.
Teacher was going to turn it on. Like, I definitely skipped school at various times when I was older, but I wasn't doing that in ninth grade.
I can't even remember how I followed this game, whether I was listening to it on the radio in the car or what. I just don't know, in someone's car, I'd have no idea.
I remember hearing a couple of teachers talking about the game. Like, just, I was, like, walking out, and they were like, yeah, that guy they have is so good, or whatever. And I was just like, we fucking lost to fucking Miami of Ohio. I heard it, and I was just like, why? I can't even pay attention. And then I think I'd recorded it on Grandma and Grandpa's TV somehow.
No, the VHS?
Maybe I'd recorded it at our house, and then I saw the highlights. I was just like, fuck it, I'll watch the highlights. I know we lost, you know?
I need to find a recap of this game.
I never actually saw that game, though, because I heard those teachers talking about it, and I was like, I cannot witness this.
I mean, just, I remember being so frustrated because...
Wally Zerbiak is going to beat us?
I mean, yeah. Like, we knew how good Wally Zerbiak was, because we mentioned last time the Sports Illustrated subscription, and there was a big feature on him leading into the season.
We talked about it on the podcast preview, on the Peltoncast preview.
He had 43 points.
Oh, my God.
In that one. And...
Wow, I'm still not over this either.
As the clock wound down inside 5 seconds, this was Donald Watts' shot was swatted away inside the final five seconds, and suddenly it was over, a 59-58 win. Greg Clark got blocked at the buzzer by Zerbiak.
Greg Clark.
Brother of current Players Association head Tony Clark.
Wait, really?
Yeah. I really connect him with the team in 2001 that was my freshman year. Of college in the first team.
There's like weirdly for how little I like truly care about Husky basketball. I'm like pretty jaded about a lot of memories, right? Like there's the Rip Hamilton shot, Mike Jensen fouling in that Illinois game, the Zerbiak game. There's Tony Roten missing the free throws.
Ugh.
I'm like kind of upset. I distinctly remember an Arizona game when Derek Williams, we were going to have this be a short segment for 99, and still haven't gotten immediate.
No.
There was a Derek Williams game
in football too.
06 or 07.
You think you've...
Maybe it was a little bit later.
Hot sauce?
No.
Derek Williams is like 12.
Okay, maybe 12, where Derek Williams, they would not call the foul on Derek Williams. Like, I'm still devastated about how Derek Williams was refereed. And we were convinced he was going to be a monster in the NBA.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, statistically, it showed out, too. In this game, so the Miami of Ohio scored 59 points. Wally Zerbiak scored 43 of them. He had 18 of 33 from the field. The rest of his teammates were combined 7 of 22. No zone defense, no double team, none of that. Where did you stay? Only three players for Miami of Ohio scored points. 55 of their 59 came from two players, Wally Zerbiak and someone named Damon Frierson. They had 0 bench points.
They had 0 bench points?
How did we lose this game? Donald Watts had 28 in his final game. Todd McCullough just 11 on 4 of 6 shooting, surprisingly. Also,
was Donald Watts drafted or he go undrafted?
No, he went undrafted. I don't think he ever played in a training camp. I once saw him play.
Kind of crazy that he... I feel like he was...
I once saw him play in the IBL with the Everett Explosion with our buddy Hewer.
Uh-huh.
Is his teammate.
Did he dominate?
He was... My takeaway from watching him up there at the Angel of the Winds Casino Arena was that he was to the IBL as Ray Allen was to the NBA.
Oh, wow.
That's how good Donald Watts was at that level. Shouts to Donald Watts.
God, Bob Bender. Honestly, like, in hindsight, you know, it's been over 20 years. We can look back on this. It's kind of fun to have a crazy Zerbiak game.
Yeah, it's a better memory. But
it would if it would have been like, yeah, that was the game that Bob Bender adjusted his defense really well and shut down Wally Szczerbiak, be like, that wouldn't be a fun memory. But maybe instead, having it be the Szczerbiak game.
But they would have played like the Andre Miller Utah team in the next round. That could have been a fun memory.
They would have gotten killed by that team.
Yeah, probably.
So
Miami only lost by 8. UW football.
Uh-oh.
First year for Rick Neuheisel.
Oh, hello.
Last week about how it was so the coaching transitions.
This was 99? Was he announced as the head coach in 99?
Yeah, because they fired Lambright.
We're sitting in Jan's basement. It is Saturday night, and we have a portable card table sitting around the table. You, me, David Pelton, maybe Michael Bernazzani. And breaking news comes on the TV that the Huskies have hired a new head coach.
Imagine an era where you found out things on the news.
The Golden Boy. We could not have been any more excited about this Rick Neuheisel hiring.
Because Colorado had beaten us in the Holiday Bowl at some point in here, right? Maybe not. I don't know. I thought that was new.
He seemed like a national level head coach.
He was up and coming, and then he brought back the gold helmets. Great move.
I mean, really.
Great first move.
Rick Neuheisel should have been, like, at that moment, if you would have told me that he was the Saban of the Huskies, I would have been like, yeah, dude. I mean, Neuheisel will be the coach for the next 25 years.
I mean, I don't know if I necessarily would have counted.
I'd be like,
but I wouldn't have been surprised if he went to another bigger job, like that he used UW as a
Rick Neuheisel always had his eye on something bigger, too.
He went and interviewed with the 49ers. Oh, Neuheisel.
There was definitely, like, we fucking love this hire, right? I don't think we've ever been more excited about
it.
I
don't remember being as positive about it. But so the Huskies that year,
this was like we'd gone from Don James to Jim Lambright, right?
Yeah.
To Rick Neuheisel, like it's night and day. We're playing on a national level now with Rick Neuheisel.
Yeah, the Huskies did lose to Colorado in a Holiday Bowl in '96.
Which and then he went out and recruited Paul Arnold and Charles Frederick?
In some order, yes. So the Huskies that year lose their opener at BYU 35-28, a really good game where they come back late and fall just short. Then they lose at home to
this
Air
was
Force.
Arizona State, is that what you said?
Air Force.
No, what was the first game?
The opener was BYU.
Oh,
the
Arizona BYU. State Thursday night against BYU?
Yes.
Oh.
On ESPN.
Should have won that game.
Yes. So they're 0-2, and you're like, uh-oh, maybe this team isn't very good.
Tui is the quarterback?
And then game three, they face, you know who they faced? Colorado.
Oh.
Pre-scheduled.
Wow.
He was much more into it.
Pre-scheduled and pre-Pac-12.
Than Coach Pete was into playing Boise State. Unveils the option, and all of a sudden, Marcus Tuiasosopo and the offense are unstoppable. The Huskies run off wins in 6 of their next 7 games. The only loss coming 28-7 at Arizona State or at home to Arizona State. I don't remember that one.
Was that Ortiz Jenkins?
No. Ortiz Jenkins the year before. Probably should have discussed that too. Suddenly they have the inside track on going to the Rose Bowl until they lose 23-20 at UCLA.
Oh,
and
my
Stanford
God.
Ends up going to the Rose Bowl.
I will remember that. We thought we were going to the Rose Bowl. Stanford, this was a really bad Pac-10 year, too.
Oh, yeah.
And Stanford went to the Rose Bowl, and I think they were ranked number 25.
That sounds about right.
Troy Walters was their star player.
Correct. The Huskies were only ranked once all season entering that UCLA game.
But I think they were better than that. Like, they were one of the
25. I mean, they ended
up
playing the number 7 Kansas State in the Holiday Bowl pretty even, losing that 24-20.
Michael Bishop?
Yes.
Wow. God, oh, man. Late 90s, early 2000s college football. This was like the peak of me playing college.
Yes.
NCAA football 2000. I would play as Kansas all the time, play as Michael Bishop.
So there you go, 99 in sports.
Wow.
Well, now let's get some media.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like we don't need to spend a lot of time in sports, but...
We did.
1999.
It was the year of the beginning of a lot of stuff in Seattle sports, 99, I feel like.
Every year is the
beginning. And the end of the Sox.
1999 was the year of the white male in music. Oh, no. I'm telling you, look at these films and tell me who
music, but...
loves these films. Oh. Well, music and film.
I mean, the Rewatchables 1999 on The Ringer also already, like, we've thought recently about a lot of these movies.
These are movies where it was like the country had prospered for a long time, right? Like, we hadn't had a war for an extended period of time. This was like 1999 was the first generation of kids that really didn't experience anything bad. Would you agree with that?
Sure.
And they're becoming teenagers.
Yeah.
Like kids who grew up in the late 80s, early 90s, and they're sort of rebelling against like their parents and the like
the hippie generation.
No, I think they're past that. They're more rebelling the against the generation. 80s generation.
Yuppie, okay.
Yeah, and so it's like this is more like we're breaking out. This is the individualistic period of white males, right? Like these movies right here are why Reddit exists. Let me just read you some of these. The Matrix. Can you imagine? Well, I'm going to read them first. Fight Club, The Sixth Sense, Blair Witch Project, Being John Malkovich, American Beauty, Office Space.
You're just going to skip over the first of the Star Wars prequels?
That's a little bit different. It's not like a mindfuck movie where you're like, oh shit. You know what I mean? Every single one of those movies is basically the same movie.
I don't know if I would go that far, but they share commonalities.
In a lot of ways where it's just like, reality isn't what we think it is, man. Yes. And you're just like, right?
Especially if you were in high school in 1999.
Can you imagine
so
being a suburban white male in high school and seeing The Matrix? Right? Like, your mind cannot, or Fight Club at the end, and you're just like...
You would do your senior class video the next year and have it be built around a Matrix parody.
That's all you could do. Right? Like, it is insane that all of these movies came out in the same year.
Yes.
And it's like, it was like, there were suburban white kids being like, we're thinking about higher level concepts. You know what I mean? Every suburban white kid became Neil deGrasse Tyson. And like,
that's what they became.
And it was just like, reality isn't what we think it is. We weren't even able to smoke weed legally at the time. And it was just like, everything's different than we think it is. You know what I mean? Because there was nothing to worry about in 1999 in the suburbs. And on the music side.
Oh, there. By the way, there.
Wag the Dog, Bill Clinton, right?
No.
Was that 98 that they had?
I think Wag the Dog was 98.
But it was like, we're pushing authority now, right? Like, this is, things are changing.
Something that.
The WTO protests.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are no people dressed up like turtles if there isn't The Matrix and Fight Club.
The Battle of Seattle. Not to be confused with the Battle in Seattle, which was Gonzaga Games.
Or the Battle of Los Angeles. Which may have also come out in 1999.
The Rams and Chargers?
No! The Rage Against the Machine album. Because
I did, because I looked that up last week. I was curious because you tweeted about the Matrix synchronization the Rage Against the Machine song, which happened, of course, in our senior class video.
They did that. Wake Up happened. Yeah. Oh my god, dude, that track. It was like they made the track 7 years earlier or something for the Matrix. There could not have been a bigger synergy. And look, let me just say, the Matrix still rules. I'm not denying that. But, like, everything that has fallen out from basically all these movies.
I gotta say, the pop psychology, like, that aspect of it, I don't feel like I'm that big of a fan of it. The action part of it still holds up.
Human beings are a disease.
Mr. Anderson.
Hugo Weaving is eternal.
Fair.
But that's what these movies were. They were all pop psychology, right? And that's like what we wanted and were looking for in 1999 as a society. That's what took, like, none of these movies were major, like, big budget films, right? They were all like cultish films that became huge from
them. I mean, they were pretty big budget, but yes, they weren't Star Wars.
And then you have Star Wars, The Phantom Menace.
I mean, Office Space was definitely my favorite of these movies by far. I didn't watch it until 2000.
But
I can remember exactly where I watched
it. Office Space still contextually is a similar movie where it's like the way that you think about everything,
sure,
it's different, right? And it's just like we're all thinking about things one way, but actually it's different. You know what I mean? And that's like really just,
it's,
if you had a
not quite a direct quote from Diedrich Bader in that movie, but it's close.
If there's a thesis statement to these films, and you're just like, wow, is that...
I remember watching that in the theater.
Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
That's like not the first one, is it?
Or that's
is it
the first one.
Oh, I definitely remember going to watch that at Lewis and Clark.
Oh, no, I thought we went in the Tri-Cities. Because I remember seeing Mike Myers on Conan one night. Mike Myers was a guest on Conan. And I was like, what is this movie? Before Austin Powers became a huge movie.
I feel like we may have seen it with the famous Cousin Katie, but I think she may have been here in Seattle.
No, we're in Tri-Cities. 10 Things I Hate About You. My God, all of my favorite movies came out.
It was also like a classic period for high school movies. I mean, Cruel Intentions.
Did Cruel Intentions? Oh, God.
Yeah, it's on the Rewatchables 1999. That was a very successful and popular series, as it turned out.
Was it?
I don't know.
I don't think that many people have that platform. But
sure. The concept was very
popular.
But
no, but so conceptually speaking, though, this is the year of like whatever you think. That's it. Whatever you think reality is,
yeah, we got
different.
I agree.
And you know what else is different?
What else is
the
different?
Phantom Menace? Star Wars is back, baby.
I feel like I was at a math competition the first night it replayed, it opened, but maybe it was when
they did the original trilogy.
It could have been. It was definitely one of those. Was the first night, and we were at the Bellis Fair Mall in Bellingham.
Wow, I almost went there this weekend.
So many people there.
Why were you at the Bellis Fair Mall?
Because we were at these math competitions in Blaine, Washington, home of Luke Ridenour.
I think I'd forgotten that Luke Ridenour is from Blaine.
We didn't know that.
Jake Locker is from Ferndale.
Yeah, it's kind of replaced with Luke Ridenour being from Blaine. But what a time.
The Phantom Menace comes out. Denny Pelton, our cousin, I remember their house being just like covered in Star Wars stuff, right?
That's about right.
I have it's probably still up there in my childhood bedroom, a full-size newspaper. This is from the newspaper, right?
It's right next to the Ken Cloud.
I'm pretty sure that's what this is. It was from the newspaper. Darth Maul face. On the ceiling. Still maybe my favorite character from Star Wars ever.
It might have been a magazine.
It is a huge Darth Maul head. And literally, Darth Maul is my favorite character from Star Wars, not because they developed any personality for the character whatsoever. They didn't bother doing that.
Just because of the look?
He just looked cool and had a dope lightsaber. That's it, and that's all I needed as a 14-year-old in 1999.
What else would you need?
I didn't get movies like Fight Club or The Sixth Sense or Being John Malkovich until years later. Right? I was only 14. Those were more like 16-year-old movies. But what I did get...
Perfect for a 17-year-old like me.
A suburban white person? Yes.
I wasn't that angry about stuff.
You don't have to be angry to have your mind blown.
That's true.
And I remember going with... You weren't there. It was me and mom and dad. And we went to the theater in Renton, actually. What is that one? The Renton Cinema, whatever?
I don't remember what it was called.
It was called something different at the time. And I remember drinking a full-size can of Pepsi before I went in and having to pee for like... it was like during the Padre scene that goes on for shockingly too long. But
as we mentioned a few weeks ago on the pod, based on the late Ron Fairley.
Yes, Proops. Proops, based it on Ron Fairley. And being like, I can't go to the bathroom because Jan will yell at me. It's like, I have to pee
That's a common theme on Let's Remember Some Years.
But if I go to the bathroom, Jan will be pissed that I wasted whatever the percentage of the probably $6 to see this movie at the time was. 1999 in music.
Wait, hold on. I want to talk about one more thing, assuming that it was 1999.
Okay.
And the timeline matches up. So I'm going to have Phil for a second while I look this up here.
Can I talk about music or?
No, because it connects to that. Okay, yes. It created in 1999 The Man Show. Very much of a piece with all of these movies.
I'm telling you, it was the year of the suburban white man.
It
right?
was. It really was.
Like, this was. Oh, man. I just saw something. 1999 music. It's all about 2001.
Of course.
There was only one record we cared about.
There was so much anticipation for that, just as there is now for Detox.
There's been a new Detox, basically.
I know.
But sitting in Christmas basement in SeaTac, we would just turn it on. Like, if you had 2001 available to you, you were listening to 2001.
What else did you need to listen to?
Yeah, there was no other music. That was it. It was like Dr. Dre invented music, but also Dr. Dre kept his ear to the streets and...
He signed Eminem?
Signed Eminem.
Wow.
And this wasn't... I said this was the year for suburban white people because it was musically too.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, Dr. Dre.
I mean, that's not for suburban white people?
Oh, no. I mean, there's that thing where Chris Rock talks about Adam Sandler being with Adam Sandler's boys or whatever in the car, and they rap along to every single word of, let me just say, those are some white guys from Boston that he's talking about. Like, this was a suburban white people year and record. And when Eminem happened,
what was the
it was
year
like,
that the, was it Sublime, the Boys in the Hood cover?
Boys in the Hood?
Yeah. You don't remember that? Somebody did a Boys in the Hood cover.
Oh, that was definitely not Sublime. The group was called, oh my God. They were called, it's a one-hit wonder. They're called like Dirt something. That might have been 99 though, actually.
It seems it's checkout.
Oh, the Boys in the Hood are always hard. Come talking that track. It was like that, right?
Yes.
God, what was that group called? This was their only popular song ever. Dynamite Hack.
Dynamite Hack, huh? Okay.
Wow.
There we go.
Wait, we have to find what year that was. I'm pretty sure that was 2000, but it was all the same.
It's definitely up a pace, yes. Yes, that was on the album in 2000.
But it was like, this was when TRL was happening. Like, pop music was, and boy bands were...
I mean, one of my defining memories of driving to baseball practice in the summer of 99 is hearing a lot of, like, the Latin takeover that year, Livin' La Vida Loca.
Wow, we were Livin' La Vida Loca.
Yeah.
But it was, I'm pretty sure I Want It That Way, it was 99.
Sounds about right.
And we were driving around in David's car, David Pelton's car, where you press the buttons on the side to get in, right? Do you remember that? It had, like, it had 1 through 10, and you would press buttons to get in the door. And we thought that was like some pretty modern shit. It was like push to start of the
late 90s. That was some
pretty
modern shit.
This was Britney Spears happens for the first time ever. Yep. Christina Aguilera happens for the first time ever. Eminem happens for the first time ever. It was like, but in even the stuff that felt edgier, it was like Enema of the State by Blink-182, pretty sure is 1999, where it's like, all of it was just like so filtered through major labels to be like as like clean as possible and tailor made for Carson Daly.
Yes. Enema of the State was 1990.
Right. It was like every single subculture that there could have been was just like, let's just clean that up and submit it to Carson Daly here.
It sounds about right.
So, like, there was pop punk happening. There was rap rock happening. I mean, Woodstock 99, which, again, I listened. What is that podcast number called? The show was called
Luminary.
Break Stuff. Yeah, on Luminary. I listened to all of Woodstock 99 on Luminary. And it was like, that's what Woodstock 99 was. Woodstock 99 was the Matrix, the Sixth Sense.
Oh, wow. The year of Believe.
That was different.
It was different.
This was the time that those kids were like, they were at the center of culture for probably the last time ever. Right? And for the last time, at least in the last two decades, when it was like the suburban white kids own culture. And I don't remember
if it was the last time, but it was the most prominently so.
I don't remember a time, because I mean, we're about to start talking about indie when we get to early 2000s.
Yes.
And it is a very different type of person we're talking about.
I agree.
And the aggressive...
Oh, Mariah Carey, Heartbreaker.
The...
Nothing?
Well, ODB, of course. Wait, no, that's Fantasy. Sorry.
November 5th, Gary Cherone leaves Van Halen.
I saw that, yeah, in 1999 in music.
Oh, wow, the first... caught person ever convicted for copyright infringement for downloading MP3s without permission, a University of Oregon student.
That checks out.
Huh.
But yeah.
By the way, can I give you a Jan thing? This is not technically 99, but I saw something that referenced this.
Always.
She was telling baby fantasy genius about David Beckham.
Uh-huh.
Because we were talking about Miami, his new expansion MLS club, and he said that he was married to Posh Spice and that they were from like the 70s or the 80s. And I was like, what?
Wow.
You were like so far off time-wise here.
She's lived through a lot of decades.
It's true. She has a lot of years to remember.
A lot of years to remember. So this was, like I said, I mean, there was a lot of indie stuff that was bubbling in 1999. Was I aware of it? Fuck no.
I mean, I guess it was more 2000 that I switched over. They had one year where I was like, I'm listening to the end instead of Q.
I think 99 was the year. Maybe it was 99, maybe it was 2000, but it was like around this time period was when I started listening to the end. Like Dynamite Hack was like, they were one of the bands that was being played on the end when I started listening.
Well, they probably were being played on both.
They were not played on Cube.
Yeah, they were.
No.
Oh, that song?
They were not playing Boys in the Hood on Cube.
That song was being played on every radio station in Seattle.
No.
They were playing it in oldies stations.
That's how big Dynamite Hack was.
Dynamite Hack.
Just wait till we get to Teenage Dirtbag.
Wait, is that long after then?
I think this was year 2000.
Okay.
We're going to find out right now. But yeah, I mean, I really think that this was the last time in culture that you could be like, and this is what has led to a lot of the stuff that's happened since then of like, yeah, year 2000, our good friends from Wheatus, where it was like the disenfranchised white man that's happened is a lot of kids who are just like, I wish it was fucking 1999 again, right? Trump's America is kids who wish it was 1999 again. From our good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com, the top 40 hip hop albums of 1999. If we can move on from that bleak moment, we have at number one from last week, it was Black Star. This week, it's one of the members of Black Star. It is Mos Def with Black on Both Sides. I can't believe that record came out in 1999. It feels much more modern. Number two, another record kind of in a similar vibe, kicking things off for Jimmy Fallon's backing band, as you know them, The Roots, Things Fall Apart. Number three, this was definitely not his best record ever, but again, starting things off here. This was, 1999 was the beginning of the indie rap movement, right? This wasn't Mad Villain, but it was Operation Doomsday by MF Doom. At number four, like we mentioned earlier, this was not indie rap, the Slim Shady LP. Come on, everybody, get down tonight. And at number five, somehow.
What? Like, look, I get that you guys are indie. I get that those were amazing CDs by The Roots.
Wow, Blacklicious at number six, too.
But 2001 is number five of 1999? How?
I don't think you know about students.
But it's still good.
Oh, it holds up. Students at Tai High School being like, Nate Dogg's smoke weed every day. Oh. That was like, that line, they didn't need to release any other parts of the record. That was it. It was like, that was the coolest shit that has ever been uttered on a song. When Nate Dogg says, cool shit, or smoke weed, cool shit every day. Cool shit every day, guys. When Nate Dogg says, smoke weed every day, it's just like, fuck me up, Nate Dogg. All right. There's no moment of that record that isn't like seared. Wow, and Pharaoh Monch too. Seared into our souls.
The very last isn't in mind because of the fact that the burned copy of the CD we had somehow cut off at the very end of it. It like got
static.
What's
that called? The Message? Where he's talking on Eazy-E.
Wait, is it Eazy-E? I thought it was like a relative.
The one that his brother too.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow. That's, I mean, 1999.
A lot of skits on 1999.
The Message outro featuring Mary J. Blige and Rel. I'm telling you, every song. Now, this is one of them occasions when the homie ain't doing it right.
Yes, I remember all the songs. I'm not disputing that.
Wow. Do you remember how much Andy this album is like that, on that song right there, whose name I can't say either the first word or the second word?
I mean, you can.
Oh, wow. And he really liked that track, too, about some L.A.
Oh, okay.
People. Pause for porno. You had to get to 22 tracks featuring how many skits were there?
Way too many.
There was an intro. Then there was the bar one skit. Wow, I'm going to listen to Explosive later. Then there was the car bomb skit for some reason.
This isn't on Spotify. It's really terrible.
This isn't on Spotify yet?
It's not on Spotify.
Man, Jay-Z's on Spotify, Dre. Let's just rectify that.
It's confusing because I think
it's because he signed a deal with Apple Music.
Yeah, but The Chronic is on Spotify, I think.
Well, that's because Death Row owns that record.
Yes, I see. That makes
sense. Or sorry, it's owned by Hasbro.
Oh, no, maybe I've got it backwards. 2001 is on here.
But...
Yeah, I've got it backwards. The Chronic isn't on here.
All right, okay, wow. We're going to have to pause this podcast because I'm going to be listening to Acrite. Hold on.
No. So much for a short segment this week. No, we can't play this.
God, in the next episode, I'm just... There's... Dude, Still DRE was the lead single from that record.
Yeah.
And it was like, it still slaps, but like, forgot about Dre. I know we're going to be sued by...
by Apple.
Well, Apple doesn't own that record. By the fine people at Interscope Records. I'll talk to them.
Yeah, you had some contacts down there. Anything else on 1999?
God, what a fucking year.
The millennium.
I'm
style.
So ready for 2001, though. 2000, I got nothing to say about. I'm ready for the Strokes to hit.
You've got nothing to say about 2000.
Was it 2003? When did this hit come out?
The Strokes have a new single?
A series of them. Wow, October 9th, 2001. Is this it? Debut album by the Strokes. Just, I think I didn't start caring about it until 2002, but...
Right.
Man, and White Blood Cells, when did that come out? We're gonna be talking about some indie bands. I'm gonna use indie in the most liberal way possible.
Yeah, understandably.
But it was indie if you were a suburban. It was indie like Office Space is indie.
I mean, also Yankee Hotel Foxtrot in 2001.
Wow, definitely didn't care about that until later either. A lot of other stuff came up.
Here's the thing I learned recently that I didn't know. So the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot album cover has a photo of Twin Towers
in Chicago. Yes, I have seen them. 2001 also for White Blood Cells.
But there's a Modest Mouse album. They kind of look like the Westin Towers in Seattle. And there's a Modest Mouse album that has those towers on the front of it.
You see these towers when you're in Chicago. I've only been to Chicago one time ever, but I've seen them. You're just like, or there, like, there's a lot of buildings.
I referred to them as the Westin when I was in Chicago because they just remind me so much of the Westin Towers. So it was very surprising to me that that there was an identical album cover.
Also, I don't know if I need to tell you this, but this record predicted 9/11.
I have read the Chuck Klosterman book so many times. It's In Killing Yourself to Live. That's probably the book I've read the most times in my life.
That's the number one book. When he's like, actually... He's like, some people say that this does, but actually, it's about the vibes of Kid A, right? Isn't that what he's talking about?
Yes. But the Westin Towers look very similar.
They're in a Modest Mouse record.
The Lonesome Crowded West.
Oh.
Which came out in 1997. We did not remember it because we were not listening to Modest Mouse at the time.
I was actually...
But that's a shockingly similar album cover, isn't it?
Maybe I should wait to... Wow, you're saying that... Yankee Hotel Foxtrot ripped off Modest
That's
Mouse.
That's precisely what I'm saying.
Two words for Jeff Tweedy. Cease and desist. I don't know if I should mention this right now or if I should save it, but... Because this didn't happen in 1999. There was... I've been pulled over maybe like three times ever in my entire life.
Zero for me.
Zero?
Yes.
Well, aren't you special? I had long hair for a while, so I was a big threat. And... The one time that I was pulled over in SeaTac, Washington, maybe Tukwila.
By the airport?
It was by the Taco Time, actually, going down the hill from the Safeway up by Tai. I was listening to music really loud. Just blaring some aggressive music. And that music was Float On by Modest Mouse. Disturbing the Peace. Oh my god.
So that was 1999.
God.
Next year we'll move into a new millennium. I can't wait.
Good thing we did that fast. Yep. We're going through 2006. Is that what we've determined?
I think so.
Can't
it's
wait.
Still TB day. It's time for...
I need to talk about Tilden Carlo Rossi back in the summer of 2006.
So we are skipping over, unfortunately, our search for Seattle's best teriyaki this week as you were unable to get to a teriyaki restaurant. Still plan to get to Teriyaki Madness at some point here.
We'll see.
Instead, we will move along to the Coach's Corner, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci has no idea what happened this weekend. And neither do we.
I mean, you don't. I was there, so I do know what happened.
I asked you how the game was, and you said, you'll see.
First off, I did go to Pagliaccia on Friday night.
Really?
Had some cheese slices.
There we go.
It wasn't that exciting.
Cheese slices?
Yeah.
Why?
Couldn't eat meat because of Lent. So, but cheese, still strong nonetheless.
Okay. Didn't have fish slices like McDonald's?
No, that would be horrifying. Please do not do that, Pagliacci. I was hoping they were going to have the broccolini, but they didn't have it on Friday. That would have been a nice play.
They
for
had
me.
No other veggie slice?
They had the agog, but that's...
You don't like the agog primo?
Nah. And they also didn't have it out at that point. So the final game of Baby Fantasy Geniuses team season was last Saturday. You were gone, and the famous Cousin Katie and I were left to coach the team. And the number one thing that stood out early on in this game is how much taller the other team was than our team.
Oh, God.
Particularly, they had one player who was really tall and pretty athletic, and Baby Fantasy Genius was our best matchup for him.
Okay.
So the first quarter, we're like doing quite well. We're hanging even. Second quarter, they rest their starters. We only have seven players.
Rest
so,
their starters?
You know, we weren't able to rotate as much. We have, like, I feel like at halftime, we might probably had a small lead at halftime.
Really?
And then the third quarter, things got away from us.
Oh, no.
The Baby Fantasy Geniuses matchup, this kid kept getting rebounds and, like, pushing it on the fast break. And Baby Fantasy Genius was stuck behind and couldn't catch up with him. Mm-hmm. And then also, we could not get a defensive rebound. Like, he kept getting offensive rebounds. They also had this one other kid who was, like, super aggressive. He was, like, played a little fast and loose with the rules.
I hate that.
Our team just will, to a fault, following the rules.
Yeah, mostly.
Definitely in terms of like just playing aggressively, like they're not that aggressive. So yeah, it got away from us in the third quarter, but you know, a decent fourth quarter. I think everybody felt good about it, because, and then at the end, trophy presentation,
hello,
where the famous Cousin Katie handed out trophies and took photos with all the kids on the team.
Katie took photos with every kid?
She did.
Are you fucking kidding me? I'm out there slaving away for three of the seven
apparently
games.
Apparently not. Yeah.
I missed many games this year.
You were at more than half, weren't you?
How many games were there? Seven? I think I might have been at four. I missed three games, I think.
There's a photo of the famous Cousin Katie and Baby Fantasy Genius.
So she gave the trophies and took photos with every kid?
She did.
This is fucking bullshit.
Could have been you.
God, it's like if Luke Walton would have accepted the rings for the Warriors championship.
I assume Steve Kerr did make it out, but he wasn't coaching that game.
Look, Kerr was there for at least 60% of the games, like me.
So, I don't know, do we have takeaways on the season as a whole?
I'm never going to coach children's sports again.
Oh, Baby Fantasy Genius said in the immediate aftermath.
I saw him crying hysterically. He was crying like he was Joey fucking Cora after that game.
Wait.
You didn't see this?
After this game?
Yeah.
No, I didn't see that.
No, he was crying like Katie was A-Rod over there comforting him. I'm telling you, he was crying hysterically.
I missed that, apparently.
Yeah, no.
But he did say that he was never going to play basketball again in the immediate aftermath. He walked that back within the next few hours after he calmed down. Although
never
then I went into...
Cora said the same thing.
I went in to talk to him about the game at one point after he had said that he'd calmed down a little bit. And he was like, go away.
That's how we respond to you with most things. Go away. Call me when you're ready to talk about 1999 again.
I think he will be willing to play basketball. He's very concerned about your lack of basketballs to practice with now that you can't use the team ones.
We've got a ball.
He does not. He disputes that.
Well, we'll get Katie to pump it up.
Exactly.
It's a full-size ball. No, I might coach his team again next year. So they split off. The kids are in second grade this year. And they split off third grade by gender because the city of Renton isn't very progressive, apparently. And
I think a lot of groups aren't progressive in terms of sports in that regard. I don't think they're unique.
But I'm like, I need Katie out there coaching with me, right? Because, like, I got shit to do on weekends. You know? I've got business trips to go on. I've got weddings to go to. Right? Like, I can't say that I'm going to be every single Saturday available.
Yes.
And I need other people. And so maybe I'll get you to do it.
Well, I travel a lot during the spring as well. It worked out well that even though both of us were only at like one game all season, I think.
Were all three of us. I think there was one game that all three of us were sitting there.
Okay, so maybe there was two that both of us. But at least one of us was at every game.
Yes.
So that was good.
Is that true?
I think so.
But I might,
because otherwise there wouldn't have been a coach's corner.
The prospects of coaching a team next year that might actually be able to listen to coaching and might actually be able to competently play basketball is kind of enticing. You know what I mean?
I think, yeah, there's a progressive development in that regard.
I feel like there has to be some point in coaching where the coaching matters. So it's like a weird curve where I feel like...
I think the coaching does matter at this level. Like, I think your team got better over the course.
We taught those kids something for sure. They were better by the end of the season than they were at the beginning of the season. But I feel like the value of coaching and the influence of coaching is like a curve where it's like, it doesn't really matter at all when they're little. And then it matters a lot for a period of time. And then once they get really good, then it doesn't really matter again. Right? Like most NBA teams could just play without a coach.
I don't know if I buy that.
Look, LeBron is coaching most of the teams. But no, it's like...
He needs to do a better job coaching the Cavs.
Hey, shoot a three. Great. Pass the ball around, shoot threes. NBA teams don't even run plays anymore.
They still run plays. You also have to choose who plays. That's an important thing of coaching.
But come on. You don't agree with this?
You don't divvy it up based on the number
of
quarters.
Okay, think about it from this perspective. Coaching is more important in college than it is in the NBA.
Sure.
That's what I'm saying. Is like, and I bet in high school it's the same thing.
But that's really far to the right of that curve. College is still like a very high level of competition.
But that's what I'm saying is like coaching doesn't matter that much when players are kids, because if you're a team, you have one player who's better than everybody else, they're going to be everybody else.
I think
better
coaching
than
matters
else.
More in Europe than or lower professional leagues than it does in the NBA too, because of the fact that there's not as wide a dispersion of talent. The dispersion of talent is the biggest factor that in the NBA means coaching is less important.
What do you mean?
Like coaching still probably matters the same amount, but there's a bigger difference between the best players in the NBA and the worst players than there is.
Oh, I think
in
that's what
basketball.
I'm trying to say is like when there are kids, there'll be some kids that are such extreme outliers through whatever, sixth grade or something like that, that I don't think coaching matters all that much, but I feel like I'm getting closer.
But there's also a player development aspect that's long term as opposed to just helping the team
teach these kids to spread the floor. Right? Like, we're just not going to shoot threes. You know what I mean?
No.
And there's a certain point where I feel like me probably having a more modern view of basketball and basketball coaching and perspectives could be beneficial for kids, but it's just, it's not second grade basketball.
No.
It means jack shit. And I want to coach them in, like, I want to coach them to shoot a lot of threes, and I also want to coach them to spread the ball around. Switch everything.
Really encouraged. There was one time where like we passed the ball and got an open shot and it was like, that's what we want to do. Let's keep doing it. We had a really tough time inbounding the ball. There was so many inbounds under the basket, and that is very difficult for us.
Yeah, if I could teach kids to fast break, like to get the inbounds in before the other team was ready, ooh, I would love that.
Katie kept yelling that it didn't really happen.
We'll see about next year.
Okay.
Anyway, sign me up. Fuck it.
Just like Baby Fantasy Genius, a quick turn from you.
Yeah.
All right, I got a quick NBA Seattle update for you this week.
Really?
Did you see this news last night? It dropped just before
Forum News.
Kevin Arnovitz and I recorded a podcast with Brian Windhorst on the Hoop Collective.
I personally do not like this news.
He reported that the Clippers and Steve Ballmer are now finalizing a deal to purchase the Forum from MSG.
James Dolan,
which they had been suing each other in a very expensive litigation over the Clippers' attempts to build an arena in Inglewood, and this would obviously resolve that roadblock. So if there was any thought you had that Steve Ballmer was going to move the Clippers to Seattle, any thought, which you shouldn't have, this would probably end it.
It is kind of like, just seeing that is kind of like Steve Ballmer's like, fuck it, we'll buy it.
For some reason I hadn't even considered that, but it is this option that makes the most sense, especially if they end up with the arena rights, like the concert rights to that new arena.
If Ballmer does?
No. If MSG does.
Oh.
Because that's what they care about.
You're saying if they're the in-house promoter for it?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's probably the logical outcome. We talked a lot about that in terms of why Oakview Group wanted to rebuild Key Arena.
Yeah, and why they don't give a shit about basketball.
We'll see.
They don't care. We know what the deal is. To care. Oh, great.
So on that note, our NHL Seattle.
They cared a lot in North Haverbrook, too. put on the map.
Thursday was the groundbreaking for the NHL Seattle training facility in Northgate. Also exciting news last week. They added Namita Nandakumar, who had been with the Philadelphia Eagles, is a senior quantitative and analyst. They are just stocking up in the analytics department at NHL Seattle.
She's transitioning from football to hockey.
Yeah, but she did work. I listened to an interview that Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin sent us that she had done while she was a student at Wharton School of Business, talking about her research into the NHL draft.
Is that a good school of business?
Yes, that's a very good school of business. Namita comes highly recommended by all corners of the internet. So an exciting addition to, again, the NHL Seattle analytics staff, which I'm judging later this week, a competition at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference.
NHL staffs. Clearly the best.
No. It's about college basketball tracking data. But one of the other judges is Alex Mandrycki, the head of that department for NHL Seattle. So
who are you judging? Ken Pomeroy? He's going to win.
No, students will be using the data. Students.
Tell them, why do we even watch college basketball?
I'm not going to tell them that.
No, you could just tell them, look, use the stats. You don't have to watch the games. It's probably more fun looking at it this way.
Yeah, it's true.
Than actually having to watch the college basketball.
Lastly, Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic reported last Thursday that the NHL Seattle organization has discussed the potential of hiring a coach as early as this summer. GM Ron Francis had previously told LeBrun that the hire was likely to come in the first half of 2021, but the group expansion team could accelerate the timeline with a number of big-name coaches available this summer.
So they would then take a year off.
The coach?
Yeah.
Yeah, and help scout.
I want to be involved with the staff.
It'd be easy. You want to get paid to not do anything for a year?
Think about how great it would be.
But do you know anything about hockey?
Neither does
who?
Nobody.
Just talked about hockey knowledge. On the Sounders front, beginnings and endings last week. We'll start with the bad news, the endings. A game we attended on Thursday. In the CONCACAF Champions League against CD Olympia, the Sounders with a 2-2 draw, a game that they needed either to draw 1-1 or 0-0 or win to advance. Instead, that game goes to penalties, where the Sounders, a couple of bad misses, lose 4-2 on penalties to crash out of the CONCACAF Champions League. They were the only MLS team not to advance
really?
From the round of 16.
It's so frustrating because they were the better team on the road and the better team at home. And they just gave up kind of bullshit goals at the end of both of those matches.
I mean, the goals in Honduras were not as far at the end of the game. I mean, I think the last one was in the 79th minute. They were, in the competitive part of the game.
That strike for the second goal that Joao Paulo had was like, whew.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That dude is a soccer player.
He's very exciting. But this was still, they weren't as dominant as they should have been playing against a team that was thousands and thousands of miles away from home.
But are they, had a weird amount of supporters?
Yes, a lot. The thought I had was that the supporters section up in the upper level, I was talking to Chris Smith before after the Talk and Taco Time pod yesterday. He pointed out that there were more fans for Olympia than there were for the Chicago Fire.
Wow.
At the opener.
So you think they traveled from Honduras?
I think a lot of them probably are people who are within the U.S. Like, when else are you going to have a chance to see CD Olympia play besides the next round because they're advancing?
Who are they playing in the next round?
I haven't looked that up. But
so you're saying just throughout, not in Seattle necessarily, because yeah, there can't be that many in Seattle.
Yeah.
But also tell them to stay away from Seattle.
but if you're in LA and you move there from...
Sure. Honduras.
I forget the name of the city where CD Olympia is based.
Yeah, CD.
Yeah. What better chance are you going to have to see them play in person besides going back to Honduras?
So that makes sense.
I figure that's a part of it.
But there were, especially during those penalty kicks, I was like, whoa, there are a lot of fans of Honduras here.
Yes. But they weren't as dominant as they should have been in that matchup. And again, they were without Nico Lodero. They were without Gustav Svensson, two key starters. But they had the severe talent advantage. They should have dominated this game. And instead, they went behind early, gave up a goal before coming back to score two.
let him off the hook.
And couldn't finish out the game.
I feel like Schmetz just didn't, I don't know if he played it right.
By bringing in Justin Dillon for Jordan Morris?
And, well, I've never heard of Justin Dillon, so I'm going to say yes. He should have known that there was a chance of penalty kicks.
It was interesting because they did not use their third sub. Could have brought in another forward, you know, another offensive-minded player. Harry Shipp ended the game on the bench to just strictly to take a penalty. Instead, they end up with Kelvin Leerdam, one of their defenders, taking a penalty that was saved. Was not real impressive.
It was over when Roldan missed that. When Roldan...
He took the air out of the building.
When he booted that shot over the goal, it was like, oh, this is over. Cool.
Olympia actually will not be playing an American opponent. They'll be playing a Canadian opponent.
Oh, hello!
Montreal Impact in the next round. So Sounders, you would have felt pretty good about their chances of advancing to the semifinals, which was my bold prediction for them this season.
Well.
Not happening.
There you
and
go.
And on our way out, I said, fire everyone.
One bold prediction down.
Oh, I think there's more than one bold prediction down already, I'm pretty R. sure. The good news, I guess, is that the Sounders had only a very short break of 3 days off before they opened their MLS season on Sunday against the Chicago Fire, celebrating pregame the MLS Cup win from last November, just a few short months ago, unveiling the banner in the rafters, showing off the trophy. Exciting start to this this one, Paris Alexis singing the anthem. And then the Sounders came out and were not good at all in the first half of this match. They gave up a goal. We're down 1-0 at halftime. And Chicago had a couple of goals that were called back for offside.
Really?
Like, they were completely dominating this game. And then at halftime, young man named Jordan Morris entered the game.
Oh, hello. So he didn't play the first half.
He didn't play the first half strictly for rest purposes. Schmetz talked after the game about how, you know, the training staff felt like with his high energy style of play, he was particularly at risk of injury if he had gone a full 90 again.
That is the one thing about, it's like you really have to sort of factor what you care about. And like, do you care about the CONCACAF Champions League?
I mean, that's not why they took him out. They took him out because they were trying to see out the game.
But no, I'm just saying in general, it's like...
Oh, but not playing these extra games?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now they've meant that they can focus a little bit more on the MLS regular season.
I mean, they really wanted the CONCACAF Champions League. That's the really real disappointment about the fact that they were the first MLS team out because, yeah, like, they were, you know, their logic was, well, we've won the Open Cup, we've won the Supporters' Shield, we've won the U.S. Open Cup.
What more can I say?
There's nothing else for us to do that we haven't done in the U.S.
Guru play the beat.
We want to try and win CONCACAF Champions League. Mm-hmm. But it was a side benefit of it. And also the fact that there wasn't extra time in that match certainly helped them with a match 3 days later. So then the Sounders get a pair of goals in the second half from Jordan Morris, who was one of the two players, knew who was
wow.
the other one who rested
Jordan
from
Morris
the starting
has
lineup.
Entered the chat.
He has. Both of them set up by Christian Roldan, who also had a near goal called back for offsides and a strong performance in this one. Aaron Ibarra got the start at left wing in place of Morris.
Had
some good opportunity.
Left wing, yes. But Nuhu also did not start.
Also did not start. Jovan Jones moved back from his right wing spot to left back to replace Nuhu. Ibarra had some good goal scoring opportunities that he was unable to finish. It was kind of a rough debut for him. He played a little bit off the bench on Thursday night. The other player who they didn't have in either of these two games, I mentioned obviously Lodero and Svensson, but Yaimer Gomez Andre at central defender was unavailable on Thursday due to a visa issue, was in the 18 on Sunday, but just didn't come off the bench. And Shane O'Neill did a reasonably solid job at center back, but one thing you saw in both of those matches, it was kind of similar to last season where it's like 90% of the time it's good, but 10% of the time it's ruin.
Yeah,
that's a bad way to go in soccer. But if you look at expected goals in that one, the Sounders completely dominated. They hit 3.8 shot-based expected goals according to the 538 Soccer Power Index model 2.5 for Chicago. So even though they didn't get the winner from Jordan Morris until stoppage time, still a deserved 3 points for the Sounders to kick off the MLS season.
Very nice.
So this weekend, they host the Columbus Crew on Saturday.
Oh, God.
We would expect Lodero back. He went through training on Saturday ahead of the match before not playing. Gustav Svensson's return, a little less clear. Columbus opened last week with an impressive win over contender NYCFC. They finished last season 10th in the Eastern Conference standings, but have remade the roster as Portland East In their second year under former Timbers manager Caleb Porter, they added both Darlington Nagbe and longtime Sounders nemesis Fernando Adi over the offseason, Adi backing up Giassi Zardes at striker. They also paid the largest transfer fee in franchise history for Argentinian number 10 Lucas Salarayan, who scored on his debut for the Crew. So hopefully the Sounders will have their number 10 South American
the
number
largest
10 Lodero.
Transfer fee in history,
club history, not franchise history, not MLS history.
Okay, what do you mean club history, like in Columbus Crew history?
Yes, that's what club means.
Okay, whatever.
I mean, they had some really good teams back in the day, but they're not a high
anybody
money player
from Columbus Crew ever.
I know some of their players, like Will Trapp was a solid USMNT fixture for. He was always very good in FIFA. I remember playing that.
Will Trapp was, also I could not.
First off, Brad Evans, ever heard of him?
Is he currently on their team?
No.
He was there before the Sounders?
Yeah.
But like, are there legendary Columbus Crew players?
There is a legendary Columbus Crew player whose name I cannot think of off the top of my head.
I don't believe that's true.
I mean, they were a force for a long time. They won the MLS Cup the year before the Sounders came into the league, and then they lost Ziggy
to
the
Sounders. Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't Ziggy their manager?
I mean, that was part of like a transition period in MLS where, you know, it had been a much more balanced league, and then the designated player expanded and the Sounders came in and raised the door and floor in terms of what kind of revenue you could generate as a franchise, and a smaller market like Columbus kind of got left behind, I would say.
Yeah. It's still Seattle. It's not like we're not Los Angeles, right?
No.
Like, Seattle's still a secondary market.
Guillermo Barros Scalotto was definitely a big star for them.
Next.
I mean, I don't know what you're looking for exactly.
I'm just saying, a lot of these teams, you know, like, this is not Thierry Henry, Wayne Rooney.
Did you know that Thierry Henry is the manager of Montreal now?
I did as of yesterday.
There you go.
Picked up his first victory.
He's facing NCD Olympia. Would have been the Sounders.
Right.
Facing
but
Thierry
you know
Henry.
What I'm saying. It's not Jozy Altidore. It's not Sebastian Giovinco.
I wonder if Thierry Henry coaches on turf. No, he played on turf. That's not.
There have been some big names in MLS, and none of them have played for Columbus.
Fine. He's still a good player.
Okay, great.
They bought him from Tigres. He was playing in Liga MX.
Okay.
All right. I guess you're very skeptical here.
Not scared at all.
UW softball went 4-4.
Isn't Pierre LeBrun like the.
What?
I feel like he has a different job.
What do you think his job is?
I feel like
is?
He's like the general manager of Vancouver Canucks.
I don't know what their GM's name is. So UW softball went 4-1 in the Judy Garman Classic.
Bowled a 300 one time.
beating number 4 LSU 3-1 and number 11 Michigan 10-2 in 5 innings on Sunday. But falling 8-6 later Friday to number 3 Texas. Gabby Plain got rocked by the Longhorns, giving up 4 runs in an inning in a third.
Bad news.
Bounced back to go the distance against Michigan, while Kelly Lynch got the win versus LSU. Sitz Bates returned to the lineup for the Huskers at shortstop. Lynch now up to a team-high 7 home runs. The Huskies this weekend will play their last...
She's a true freshman?
Yeah.
7 home runs?
Yeah.
And has basically only played the best teams in the country.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there have been some weaker opponents mixed in there.
But not that many.
The last tournament this weekend for the Huskies, they will play the Silicon Valley Classic in Santa Clara and San Jose. Will not face any ranked opponents
that
in that one.
That doesn't seem right, that they're not facing one of the 10 best teams in the country.
I know, it's very odd.
Multiple.
I guess because it's the last tournament before they start conference play, you want to wind it down a little bit. No, they still are playing USA softball the day before they begin their first series of the Pac-12.
I don't think, I mean, I suppose if there are any takeaways from this gauntlet that UW softball has played, it's that, A, we know that they're extremely good.
Yes.
They will definitely be a competitor for the national championship again. And B, maybe they're not by far and away the best team.
Oh, no, for sure they're not. I mean, UCLA continues to go along undefeated, I believe. I don't think they lost this week. So they are, again, the favorites, despite the couple of players they lost to USA softball in the Olympics. But, yeah, those two teams have not faced off. They've been in the same tournaments, but on opposite sides of the bracket or whatever.
On.
So I wonder whether they play here or in LA. Look that up at some point. UW women's basketball ended the Pac-12 regular season last weekend with a 75-61 loss on Friday at number 17 Oregon State, and then a 92-56 loss Sunday at number 3 Oregon in the last regular season game for Sabrina Ionescu and company. Huskies still finished ninth in the Pac-12 standings at 5-13, their highest finish since 2016-7, and will face number 8 seed Utah in the Pac-12 opening round on Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m.
A three game set to begin May 1 through 3rd at UCLA.
The Huskies lost their only head-to-head matchup with the Utes during the regular season, 74-65 at Heck Ed in February. The good news, if you win this game, is you get to face Oregon in the second round. You have men's basketball. The Basketball Apple Cup did not go so great this year.
We got to get on getting some of this softball tickets.
We do. A 78-74 loss for the Huskies at home to the Cougars assured the Huskies of now finishing last in the Pac-12 as they dropped to 3-13 in conference play. The highlight of this game, I would say, was the senior day move to start walk-ons Jason Crandall and Quinn Barnard along with Sam Timmons. Crandall scored a tip-in for the first bucket of the game, and they had a positive point differential. As I noted on Twitter, Crandall and Barnard, the two walk-ons, the only Huskies in the first half with a positive point differential as they trailed by double digits at the break. Did you pay any attention to this game?
I was on the treadmill and I was watching it, and I was thinking, I fucking hate this team. I hate this team. I hate the sport. Hate everything about it. And then I saw a welp from you on the chat, and I was like, great.
They staged a solid comeback in the second half, got even pretty early in the second
against
half.
Against Wazoo.
Yeah, I mean...
At home.
Yeah, no, I mean... Then Wazoo got hot, hit a bunch of threes in a row after Jamal Bey got called for a technical for taunting. And then the Huskies...
The Huskies, they probably lead the Pac-12 in techs.
They've got to lead the Pac-12
good
in techs.
Good God!
It is really ridiculous.
They're not good enough to have this many technical fouls.
Late, they brought in Raekwon Battle, who hadn't played all game, and Elijah Hardy, who had maybe his best effort of the season, I would say. And they helped get the Huskies back into this. And
is Paolo a junior or a senior?
Paolo Banchero, he's a junior.
Cool.
I have another year to sell him. Gonzaga doing a pretty good job of it. The Huskies then have a shot to tie in the final 30 seconds of this game, but Naz Carter,
spoiler alert,
drive comes up empty on that opportunity, and Wazoo was able to salt the game away with freshman Noah Williams, a Seattle product, at the free throw line, and that was that.
Well, the good news that I can say about Husky basketball is that daylight savings time is coming.
The season is almost over. The Huskies will finish Pac-12 play this weekend on Thursday at Arizona State, Saturday at Arizona. ASU surprisingly tied for third in the Pac-12, a game ahead of Arizona, which is ranked 17th in KenPom, is compared to 58th for Arizona State, who's just two spots ahead of the Huskies, but have won. Let's see, I believe they're 11-5, so they've won eight more conference games.
Are they in the tournament or on the bubble?
They must be on the bubble. They've been getting votes in. I mean, I haven't really been paying close attention to the bubble. I got to be honest with you. Now that
I don't know. I have no idea which teams are in the tournament or on the bubble or whatever.
That's interesting.
You could tell me any team was going to be a number one seed. I'd be like, all right, that seems reasonable.
Arizona is a 6 seed. Arizona State is a 10. So both should be in at this point. USC, one of the last 4 buys. Stanford, one of the last 4 in. And UCLA, I think, is now comfortably in, I assume.
Oh, my God.
They're going to win the Pac-12.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
San Diego State is a 1 seed?
Yeah, San Diego State only has 1 loss all season.
Wow.
That's a thing. San Diego State, there could be 2 1 seeds from the, could be 2 1 seeds from the West Coast. For the Pac-12. Obviously, Gonzaga being the other one there.
It's kind of wild how West Coast basketball is not bad. It's just the Pac-12 is bad.
Just the Pac-12, yeah. Yeah.
So who's the highest seeded team in that from the Pac-12?
Oregon is a 4.
So this is like an up year. This is like a good year.
Relative to last year, yeah.
And the best seed is a 4 right now?
Yeah.
Why don't we just, let's just...
drop men's college basketball?
Call it the West Coast Conference. Parody is bad, folks.
Let me tell you, Mark Few is still so upset about the Lorenzo Romar Cameron Dollar situation that he would never let UW into the West Coast Conference. I mean, he really wouldn't. He would probably be like a little bit scared of us threatening their dominance there.
We'd kill them at football.
By the way, the West Coast Conference...
they don't want to see us in softball.
...has obviously Gonzaga is a one seed. St. Mary's is an 8, and BYU is a 6. So there you go.
If they played Pac-12 schedules, none of those teams would be that high.
They might be.
Gonzaga would be a 4 seed if they played a Pac-12 schedule.
I think they'd be just fine.
They would not be a number 1 seed. I don't believe that.
Maybe they'd be a 2. Should we talk about the Seahawks? A report from the ESPN Combine Roundup by ESPN's Dan Graziano and Jeremy Fowler indicates the Seahawks are, about the Seahawks, unlikely Seattle goes to $18 million to $20 million per year for a player in Jadeveon Clowney who had 3.5 sacks in 2019. The Seahawks value him highly, but don't want to break the bank.
We'll miss you, Jadeveon.
Additional context.
This was the saddest news.
It was distressing. Additional context from Mike Duggar, the Seahawks beat writer for The Athletic. Seattle. One takeaway from talks with people at the Combine was the significance of Clowney's low sack total in negotiations. There seems to be more emphasis on the optics of a $20 million a year player with those low sack totals than I thought. He'll get paid, but that nugget was interesting.
So this is in general or just for the Seahawks?
Unclear.
Because if the Seahawks are saying he didn't, look, use whatever you need to for a negotiating ploy, but like the open market knows that Jadeveon Clowney is not a 3.5 sack player.
They have access to ESPN's pass block win or pass rush win rate, where Clowney was an elite player.
I mean, he is an elite player. He missed a lot of games, or at least he missed a chunk of games. But like when Jadeveon Clowney plays, he's
disruptive.
He's one of the best pass rushers in the NFL.
Yes.
Like, and he should be paid equal to the top 5 franchise level pass rusher. If the Seahawks just franchised Jadeveon Clowney and paid him that number, nobody would complain about it.
Of course not. No.
So it's like, who cares about the sacks? Like, really, the sacks don't matter. You know? Like,
I mean, they matter, but they're not a definitive measure of a player's value.
If the Seahawks for a variety of reasons actually are judging Jadeveon Clowney, I mean, by how many sacks he had last year, that is a poor way to judge him as a player.
I mean, particularly the term optics, because that implies like you know that it actually is not that meaningful.
Yeah, yeah. And people are gonna make fun of you, like, right? Like all the other GMs are gonna be like, "Hey, do you see the Seahawks paid $20 million to a 3.5 sack player?"
And it's so like, weird because it's not like that. Seattle fans are like, "Oh, Jadeveon Clowney is gonna be too expensive. We gotta let him go." No one thinks that.
Nobody cares about the optics, right?
No, the optics are good. The optics would be bad if they let Jadeveon Clowney go, especially if the money isn't like, you know, if the money is like $24-25 million a year, I'll be like, hey, like I get it. I like Jadeveon Clowney too, but there's other things you can do with that money. But if it is in fact,
what is Khalil Mack paid?
In the $18-20 million range, then it's going to be a very disappointing.
This is the same team. I just feel like they're kind of bad at judging where to spend their money. Like they let and I don't know how Sheldon Richardson has necessarily been after this, but I remember when he signed that 1 year deal with Cleveland. Was that where he signed it?
Or
was
that Minnesota?
Minnesota first. It was like he got paid that and we wouldn't match this. Like you can't just want cheap players, you know, because you'll never have a pass rush if that's the case. If every year you're just like, well, we'll sign Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill in their prime for free, basically. Like, that's not going to happen. And also, you got to start hitting on some draft picks at some point, which they have not. It's like, don't worry about Jaren Reed. If you let Jaren Reed walk, nobody is complaining. But spend the money to bring Jadeveon Clowney back.
Khalil Mack's average salary is 23.5 average annual value.
Okay, so they probably shouldn't pay him that much.
I think, yeah, that would be a bit rich. Like I said, we talked about this at the end of the season pod with Ben Baldwin, and I said, if you know, you match Frank Clark's contract, I think that's a good outcome.
Frank Clark
getting paid? 20.8 average. The most for a player listed as a defensive end, looking at Spotrac here, would be DeMarcus Lawrence at $21
million. That's the range. Wait, do you have the top five there?
Trey Flowers at $18 million is third, Cameron Jordan at $17.5 million, D Ford at $17.1.
So you're basically paying him franchise money.
Yeah. The franchise tag is $19.3 million. That's what Yannick Ngakoue is going to schedule to get.
Pay him that.
Yeah.
Do it. I mean, Right now.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe they could do it right now.
But the, I believe that in free agency, there are other teams who are out there that would pay Clowney that number.
I think there probably are. The one thing that bothers me is when people are like, oh, he wants to reset the market. Well, sure. Everyone wants to reset the market.
Sure, we'd all like to reset the market.
I mean, I think that does matter to a certain extent because you're probably, if your value comes in less than you expect it to, I think you're probably more likely to change teams because you're more upset at your current team for not valuing you than that other team.
Do we have the pass rush win rate up? Like, is Clowney worse than these players?
I think he's probably ahead of most of these players, but behind some other ones, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I mean, those players aren't on the market, right? Like, we know that timing is always a factor for these things. And that's why, like, you know, Matthew Stafford, despite, like, nobody would argue that Matthew Stafford has ever been the best quarterback in the NFL, but he was the highest paid quarterback. He was the highest paid player in the NFL for a while.
We should be clear that 18 to 20 million would still be a lot of money for this position, but, you know, salaries escalate over time. That is sort of how it works. Clowney last season was seventh in pass rush win rate. The players ahead of him, Robert Quinn, TJ Watt, DeMarcus Lawrence, Myles Garrett, Shaquille Barrett, and Joey Bosa.
But I mean, think about the assets that teams have spent on those players.
Yeah, most of these are guys who are, a lot of these guys are players who are still on their rookie contracts.
I feel like we could have drafted TJ Watt. It's so stupid. It's so clear that TJ Watt was going to be good. But like, okay, the Browns had to spend the first pick on the draft on Myles Garrett.
Correct.
And the Niners had to spend the second pick in the draft on Nick Bosa.
Who did not make this list, by the way. That was Joey Bosa.
Oh, Joey. Okay, so also the second pick in the draft, right? Or third?
I don't remember.
Top three pick in the draft. But it's like, there's a difference. You spend money, and then also you spend resources. And the Seahawks have spent no resources on Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like, I don't think that, like, they should just pay him whatever because of that. But the key thing is, there's only a couple ways you get these players. Either you have the top five pick, or you spend a lot of money on them in free agency. The Seahawks aren't going to have a top five pick.
Or you know that it's J.J. Watt's brother and he's going to be awesome, and you just fucking draft him. I don't know. He was like 17 or something, T.J. Watt.
That sounds vaguely correct. Yeah, so
re-sign Jadeveon Clowney. There's no pass rush beyond that.
I mean, because the point is you're going to have to pay someone else to do it. I don't know what the other alternative is.
Pick 30. So the Seahawks definitely could have drafted TJ Watt. Nice one. But it's a specific system.
And he's more of an outside linebacker than he is a stand-up outside linebacker than he is a hand-in-the-dirt rush end. Although Clowney was in Houston before converting to that in Seattle. So that's not, you know, an impossible thing to do. Another possible reason, by the way, that his sack rate was a little artificially low last season.
It just doesn't matter. I just don't care about sacks. Like,
you should care to some extent about sacks. You just should care about future sacks rather than past sacks. You shouldn't pay the guy who has an abnormally high sack rate and that's not going to continue, which to an extent was Frank Clark last year.
Don't make
year.
Me tell you who the Seahawks drafted first in that draft.
Oh, it was Rashad Pettit.
No.
Oh, was it? Oh, this is 17, not 18. Oh, they drafted
Malik McDowell.
Yeah.
Well. From Jack. So wait, what pick? Oh, they had the 26th pick.
Which, I mean, trading down is generally a good thing. In fact, that was what Namita Nandukumar was talking about on that podcast about her research on the NHL draft.
Well, I hope she likes Malik McDowell.
I don't know if she has these particular positions on that specific pick. She wasn't with the Eagles yet, so we can't evaluate their draft picks based on her influence.
What year was she on the Eagles?
Last year would probably be the only draft. She was an intern in 2018.
Damn, that's a meteoric rise.
Well, she was still finishing school at that point.
Andre Dillard?
Yeah, I don't know. The Eagles may not have had the best year, but I don't think you
like your first year with the team, they're just going to turn over the draft to you.
It's like I take credit for Paul George all the time. Paul George and Lance Stephenson.
That's what they do.
All man.
An NFL franchise, every single pick. They're like, hey, it's your first year. Are you ready to make all the picks? First round pick. GM doesn't care. Coach doesn't care. Like Miles Sanders. Not bad.
Well, let's talk about the Seattle Dragons wrapping up here. Who on Saturday suffered a 23-16 loss to the St. Louis Battlehawks, trailed 17-3 at halftime and then totaled just 55 yards of offense on 20 plays with two first downs. And that's when Jim Zorn finally decided to let B.J. Daniels cook.
Was B.J. Daniels playing?
No, he wasn't.
Brandon okay, so Silvers there's a difference played. Between letting him cook and also letting him play at all. Wow, well, the first Eagles made like no draft picks last year.
You got to let him play to let him cook. That's a necessary qualifier here. It's, you know, it's like squares and rectangles. Brandon Silvers was 4 of 10 for 27 yards at the half.
Quadrilaterals.
Daniels was only okay, I would say, through the air. It was actually kind of similar to Silvers' performance over the course of the year, where a lot of his yardage came on one big play, a 57-yard touchdown pass to Alonzo Moore. Was 5 of 10 for 100 yards, but he ran 7 times for 84 yards and led back-to-back touchdown drives to get the Dragons within 4. It's weird to be on the other side of the Hawks here. Somewhat inexplicably, then the Dragons went for 3, trailing by 4 points.
What do you think they should have done?
Probably, I mean, you could say that the safe play would be to go for 1 and get within a field goal.
What do you have to do to go for 1?
I believe it's the 2-yard line.
So there's no extra points.
No extra points.
Okay, so you have to go.
No, you're gonna watch an XFL game at some point. You'll figure it out. I don't know.
You're talking fucking nonsense here. This is like rock and jock football that you're talking about.
You're like, go for 3. Yeah. There's
you're
different
like,
yard
lines. They made a 5-point shot.
There's different yard lines that you go for.
Then
one.
Matt Stone had to go for it after.
Then someone came out and was trying to distract them. What year did basketball come out, by the way?
I think that might have been 99. Really, Eagles only made 5 draft picks last year. Andre Dillard, Miles Sanders, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside.
Arcega.
Sharif Miller and Clayton Thorson.
Arcega-Whiteside did not work out real great.
I don't really know if any of those did. Their best player from that list is a running back. So
yes, but you'd want to be within 3 or 2. Really, being down 1 doesn't help you all that much in that situation.
Okay. What? So okay, wait. What happened? They were down 4, and then they went for 3.
Yes. And missed that one. So the score is 2016.
Are there field goals?
Yes, there are field goals.
So they should have gone for 2 because then they would have won with a field goal.
I think that's probably the most logical play. So the Battle Hawks then tacked on a field goal for a 7-point lead. Dragons took over with 8:10 left and drove to the St. Louis 37 before a holding penalty put them in a desperate situation, and Daniels threw an interception on 3rd and 20, essentially an arm punt. St. Louis then ran out the final 3:56 of the game, picking up 4 first downs, the last coming from one Kristen Michael Sr.
Oh, wow.
But the only thing he did wrong was not being drafted by the Dragons. The Dragons' defense shut down the St. Louis running backs in general, but struggled against quarterback Jordan Tamu, who threw for 9.8 yards per attempt and ran for 63 yards.
He's like a superstar in XFL, right?
He is. This week, they will face the Houston Roughnecks, staying on the road on Saturday at 2 p.m. on ABC. The Roughnecks are the last unbeaten team in the XFL at 4-0 under longtime college coach June Jones and one-time Atlanta Falcons head coach. Yeah. Have gotten solid play from quarterback Philip Walker, a Temple product who spent time with the Colts practice squad and leads the XFL with 987 yards passing, though his 6.7 yards per attempt are less spectacular.
It's June Jones' system
right
now.
Run and shoot, essentially. Wide receiver Cam Phillips leads the XFL in receiving yards and combined for 6 touchdowns in weeks 2 or 3 before being held to just 1 catch for 9 yards last week in their win over the Dallas, whatever
the modern
team.
Colt Brennan.
Yeah. The defense has also been the best in the XFL, picked off Landry Jones 3 times last week in the Battle of Texas. So a tough test coming for the Dragons. We'll need. I was about to call them Battlehawks. Yeah,
I was going to call them the Seahawks.
Could have been any of them. A tough test coming for the Dragons, who will need a strong effort. Jim Jordan did not commit to B.J. Daniels as his starting quarterback going forward, but he's got to, right?
Come on,
let Daniels cook. They're going to need a big effort for him if they're going to avoid dropping 2-1-4 on the young XFL.
Are
season.
There for, like draft picks that you pick up by being bad?
Probably.
Great.
I don't know. The last XFL did not last multiple seasons.
I was going to say, this may be it, so you might want to win now.
I think the XFL is going to hold on for at least a second season. I'm pretty confident of that.
Mm-hmm. We said the same thing about Dynamite Hack after Boys in the Hood.
Oh, yeah. Definitely when you cover another artist's song and have a random big hit, that always translates. into success.
Oh my god.
Just like this podcast is translating into success. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Oh, damn, Dynamite Hack. This is like a one-hit wonder that's been like kind of forgotten. Dynamite Hack has 93,000 monthly listeners. Like, this only has 8 million plays. I feel like a lot of the other one-hit wonders are like hundreds of millions.
Agreed.
You know, how many do you think Teenage Dirtbag has?
At least double that. Let's go with that.
I mean, it was a cover song, so it's like not quite the same.
Right.
What were you saying for Wheatus?
I said at least double that.
Oh, way more. 100 million. 203 million for Teenage Dirtbag.
Well, there you go.
Right? Like, Wheatus is still making money off this. Man, that Dynamite Hack came out of nowhere. The most successful thing that's happened in Dynamite Hack in the last 20 years, 15 years, is you accidentally thinking they were Sublime. There's definitely like the person who's running Dynamite Hack Twitter, I assume the lead singer of Dynamite Hack, is like, they thought we were Sublime for a second. It's like,
should I say tag Dynamite Hack in our tweet about this?
Tag Dynamite Hack. See if they have a Twitter.
Our good friends at Dynamite Hack. I feel like they're probably more of a MySpace kind of band.
And we'll talk about this next week, but I swear to God, there's an interview in the end that I remember hearing with the Wheatus lead singer where he was like, they were like, so how do you get your voice so high? They're like, is that somebody else or is that you? And he was like, yeah, that's me. And they're like, how do you do that? He was like, it's called range. And I was like, wow, you're never going to have another popular song ever again in your entire life.
It's are you called wasting that this range. Year? Why are you just wasting this material?
I wrote Teenage Dirtbag. Thank you. He's like when Matthew Lillard tweeted about having range. You listen to Jason Segel talk about being an SLC punk?
No.
Jason Segel, you listened to the interview with him. He was talking about the early movies that he was in. And he was in SLC punk and it was like, psh.
What? I don't know what that is. I guess it just went right by me.
It's a Lillard vehicle.
Is it?
It was a great movie to all indie kids in the early 2000s.
Was Scooby-Doo not a Lillard vehicle? That was he was in that, right?
Yeah, he was, but SLC Punk was a Lillard vehicle.
Like, it was a star-driven project.
Yeah, like, Scooby-Doo, really, I feel like the IP is the star.
Obviously, but how about the performance by the husband and wife duo of...
Freddie Prinze Jr.?
Yeah.
Man, I remember one time watching
and Sarah Jeopardy. Michelle Gellar.
So, I was watching Jeopardy one time. I remember this. And they were like, they went to the judges for this. And the answer was Freddie Prinze Jr. And the person said Freddie Prinze Jr.
Did Trebek at least give him like the thing where he's like, ooh, sorry. Like, he lowers his voice when he's talking, when he's correcting someone.
He was like, judges, sorry, it's Prinze.
And then Sean Connery was like, harsh but fair, Trebek.
I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby.